It's Friday, the 1st of November, 2019, and this is HBR episode 2935, entitled The Work of a Firefighter, Part 3. It's hosted by Jeroen, and is about 30 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is the continued introduction into the work of firefighters.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello and welcome to another episode of one of my podcasts, and this is the third one in my series on firefighting. So let's first start with the questions I got. I got a question from Ken Fallon saying he was rather disappointed about the parking habits of his neighbors in his neighborhood, because a lot of cars are parked on top of the underground fire hydrants. His question was, well, do we crush the cars or not? Well, unfortunately, we don't. There are mitigating things that we can do to get water. Because, well, as soon as you have rescued any and all victims, it's time to try to put the fire out using, on average, water. Except where you don't use water when there's an electricity fire, and you don't use water when there's a gasoline fire, because gasoline floats on top of water, so you only increase the burning area. What we do with the gasoline fire is we intermix the water with a special soap, and it produces foam. And the foam will cut off the oxygen to the gasoline fire, and thus extinguish the gasoline fire. So all kinds of oils and gasolines and whatnot can all be extinguished using foam, and everything you need to produce foam is on the standard truck that that gets out to the incident. The other thing is, suppose that you arrive at the scene and all underground water hydrants are covered, and you desperately need water. There is a system that, well, in Dutch it's het groot watertransport, but it would translate to large water transport. And it's a truck, and the truck has a container on top of the truck, and it contains a really, really, really long hose that also is very big if you would cut through it, the diameter, it's I believe something like 15 centimeters or something. In the container is also a diesel engine and a hydraulic pump. So what happens is the truck will go to any place that has a large body of water, a canal, a big pond, whatever, something with a large amount of water. And it will put down the container. It will then remove the diesel engine from the container, place it on the soil, on the ground, and throw the hydraulic pump into the water. And this hydraulic pump is clearly has two hydraulic hoses attached to it, and also the water hose. And when you start this diesel engine and you get the oil flowing, it produces a large amount of power to pump water, and this can go up to 2400 liters per second. So that's all per minute. Anyway, it's a lot, trust me. Next, the truck will lift the container, the remaining container with the remaining hose on its back, you know, on the truck, because it contains something like 1.5 to 3 kilometers of hose, and it will start driving at the average speed of 40 kilometers an hour, which is pretty fast. Well, it's not highway fast, but it's nevertheless. And while it's driving, the hose is pulled out of the container simply by driving. So that gives you within a radius of 1.5 or 3, depends on the system, kilometers around the diesel engine, gives you an outlet for water, and you can connect your gear to it, your firefighting gear to it. And once they start pumping, it's a lot of water that they pump. It's you can feed more than one truck. I believe something like 3 or 4 trucks can simultaneously be fed from this one system, where all trucks have 3 to 4 hoses deployed. So it's a lot. But this truck has to drive to the location where he needs to be deployed. So it's not like give me this large water and it will be there in the next 3 to 5 minutes. So you still have a problem if your car is parked on top of fire hydrants. But given time, there will be enough water on site. What do you do in between? Well, you could start with using 2 trucks, one a few blocks away that's able to attach to the first fire hydrant and will pump to the second truck, and the second truck will deploy water. So that works too, if the situation calls for it. So there are alternatives in place in case somebody somebody's parked their car on top of fire hydrants. Now the other question was, somebody, let me get this right. Okay, this is by Steve. Steve says, you've said that you are a volunteer firefighter. I'm wondering if most firefighters in the Netherlands are volunteers. In the US, there are volunteer departments, for sure, in rural and small-town areas. But most of the medium to large cities have fire departments where the firefighters are employees of the city or council or country. Well, it's similar to the Netherlands. It's similar. We talk about volunteers and we talk about professional firefighters, but at the same time, in the Netherlands, they are they have a contract with the same organization. It's just by history it's called volunteer, and by history it's called professional. But both of these individuals, either what we call volunteer, what we call a professional, is being trained and paid and managed by the same organization. In the Netherlands, it's the same. The large cities have what we call professionals, which means that they will come to the station for 24 hours, do that, and then they are off for 48 hours until they have another shift. And that's because it's pretty expensive to have people on a regular salary. But if you have, let's say, more than 7-8 incidents per day, it just is cheaper to have people on a contract than using volunteers. On the other side, all the other towns, and those are, you know, smaller than 100,000 inhabitants or something, they all have volunteer firefighters. Still on contract with the same organization, but they have an exercise evening once a week, regular exercising on theory and practice of firefighting and everything it entails. And they have a beeper, a pager, and as soon as that goes, that starts beeping, you hurry to the station, you put on your suit, and you get in this big red van and go do your thing. If you look at the numbers, let's put it like that, the numbers, the ratio between them, it's, well, about 80% of all firefighters in the Netherlands are volunteer firefighters, because 80%, or let's say, put it the other way, only 20% of the Netherlands is occupied by big cities, and all the other ones are rurals and smaller towns. So the most part, the volunteers are by far and large the biggest portion of firefighters in the Netherlands. So I hope that answers the question of Steve. Now, I have prepared a few other subjects that I would like to discuss with you. The first one would be breathing. You know, when you get into a fire-infested house or building, there's a lot of smoke, there's a lot of heat, and there are even occasionally flames. So it's not really healthy to breathe in and out in that kind of environment. The air is too hot, it will burn your lung cells will start shriveling and start leaking body fluid, and you will drown in your own water, your own body fluid. So it's not really healthy. So you need something, and that's of course a breathing apparatus. You got a tank full of breathing air. It's not oxygen, it's just regular air that's all around you in this tank. Now think about this for a minute. It's a tank, its contents is for 6 liters, and its pressure is 300 bars. And so how much liter of air is that? Well, it's simple, a matter of multiplication. 6 liters times 300 bars is 1800 liters of breathable air inside this tank. Okay, clearly that's something that can run out. So what are we talking about? How long will it last? Well, that's the trick. So see, if you do normal breathing, you breathe 6-7 inhalations per minute, you're relaxed, nothing really going on, and maybe on average you breathe 4 liters per breath, so that makes 24 liters. And if you try to get 24 liters out of this tank, it will last you 75 minutes, which is more than an hour. It's pretty much. But you get into the building, you're working with a hose, maybe it's already filled with water, so it's heavy. Maybe you have a high pressure hose, so it's not so heavy. But at some point, maybe you encounter a victim, somebody laying on the floor, clearly unconscious, and you need to get him out of there as soon as possible. Well, the only way to do that is by dragging or lifting. So there are several procedures. In the Netherlands, they use a lifting technique called Rautek. In Belgium, they have a completely different technique. I think it's a better one, but we get to that later. So you pick up this person, average weight 70-80 kilograms, with 2 persons, and you start maneuvering back to the exit. Now at that time, you're talking about serious physical exercise. and your inhalations will increase, and they can increase up to 40 or 50 per minute. So 40 or 50 per minute, let's say 40, at 4 liters per breath is 160 liters per minute, and then your tank is just enough for 11 minutes. And that's not a lot. So it's in, maybe find a victim, and get out as soon as possible. The other thing, that's a nice thing about this tank, this breathing apparatus, there's a physical, mechanical, that's better, it's a mechanical buzzer built-in that starts sounding a sort of a beeping sound, not beeping, but it's a that kind of sound, and it starts to do that as soon as the pressure drops below 50 bars. So at 50 bars, you know that it's time to really hurry up and get out as soon as possible. Normally, you're trained to look at your gauge, your pressure gauge, as much as possible, as often as possible, so you, and you should be out of the building before it starts. What's the word for it? It's not beeping. Well, you know what I mean. You know, it's whistling or something. The sound. So if you get out of the building while this thing is whistling, it's you've not done a good job thinking about your own safety. Okay, no heroism. That's all those that stuff. That's crap. It's fake. Think of your own safety, and that's the only way you can think of others to help as well. So, worst case, 11 minutes to get out, and it can be a challenge. Now, the other thing is, when you're inside a building, how do you maneuver about? How do you walk about? How do you orient yourself? Because the thing is, you don't see nothing. I think that's bad English, but you get the point. It's not black, it's gray in front of your helmet. It's because of the smoke. You don't see anything. So you can't just start walking around and hoping for the best. So what do? It's simple. You always keep in close contact with the wall, either on the left side or on the right side, but nevertheless, one of the sides it's gonna be. And so this is, we can try this if you're at home. I don't do this in your car, because it not only looks weird, but it could turn out dangerous. So don't try to mimic what I'm telling you while you're driving. Please don't. Okay, so suppose I am following a wall on the left side. So on my left I have a wall, and I'm in contact with it with my hand. Now, I wouldn't use the palm of my hand, because if there are electricity leads that have been suffered from the fire, then the copper is exposed, maybe even still containing a high voltage on them. That's unhealthy. So you use the back of your hand to follow, to guide yourself along the wall, because as soon as your back of your hand touches a hot lead, it will spasm the muscles and create a fist, and that's not bad, because it will get your hand away from the hot lead. So that's to be on the safe side. Now, the other thing is, you want to not only keep in touch with the wall, but you also want to check for light switches and those kind of things. So you keep moving your arm up and down to follow the in a wavy kind of movement up and down against the wall. The other arm on your right side also has a function, although you're following the wall on the left. And that's because you want to shield yourself and your mask from any hot leads or piping or whatever sticking out of the ceiling above you and that you could occasionally maybe run into. So you have a similar wavy gesture with your right arm, but not to your right, but more to your let's say in front and above you. So it's above and in front of your face. Though that kind of wavy thing. I know it looks silly, but in practice they thought about it and it works. So, and nah, nobody sees it because, well, you know, you can't see anything, so nobody sees you doing silly stuff. Now, those are the arms. We also have two legs left. Well, one of the legs is your standing leg. And the standing leg, if you're following the wall on the left, is the left leg, your standing leg. So that's the one that your weight is standing on. And the other leg is used to touch in front of you if there are maybe with a wooden floor or something like that, openings, gaps where you could fall into. So you're using your right leg to feel if there is a hole in the floor. And if there isn't, then you will move your left leg, not in front of your leg, but at the same line, so they're next to each other. So you only increase steps with your right, and you get your left one up to the right before you move the right one a little further. Okay. Well, if you it takes some exercise, I know, but at some point it's just as normal as swimming or walking or, well, you know, those are all those things that say that they say you never, once you get the hang of it, you'll never forget it. So that's the walk, you know, do the talk, walk the walk, talk the talk. Now, there are two more things I'd like to talk to you about, and those are those typical fire behavior that maybe you've heard of them, maybe you haven't, but it's the flashover and the backdraft. Now, what does that mean? Well, the flashover is basically rather simple. What happens is the fire will sort of jump from one piece of furniture to another. Now, that's strange. Why would a fire jump? Well, just imagine you have a room and there's a fire on the couch, and the temperature increases, the fire increases, and with every fire there's a massive amount of infrared radiation, you know, heat, warmth radiation, heat radiation. And this infrared radiation will also touch, fall upon, whatever you call it, on furniture that's not already burning. But simply by the infrared light, it will start to decompose whatever the material, whatever it is, and thus creating flammable gases that are not yet on fire, because the ignition temperature is not high enough. But nevertheless, it is this other piece of furniture is creating gases, and at some point the temperature in the room will increase to that level that the earlier generated gases will ignite, and then you sort of have a jump of a fire from one piece of furniture to another. So that's a flashover. It is what it is. It's not pretty spectacular, but it's just a way of describing what's happening during a fire. And the other one is the backdraft. Now, the backdraft is something that most of you have heard about. I've heard about it. There have been a few movies about it. And the movies, especially the movie Backdraft, listen, it's a movie, okay? It's the way it's portrayed is not realistic, but I think you already guessed that. Nevertheless, backdraft itself is hugely, hugely dangerous. Let me describe it like this. So you have a room in your house, and there's a fire in this room. So a lot of heat is produced, a lot of gases, burn gases are created. It's all on fire, all the oxygen is being used, but the room is closed. The door is closed, the windows are closed, etc. So at some point in time, there is oxygen depletion and the fire will extinguish. But there is still a lot of energy left in the room in the form of temperature. So all these materials that were burning keep on producing flammable gases simply because it's very hot in the room, but they can't burn because there's no oxygen anymore. Okay, now, so far so good. At some point, let's imagine somebody opens the door. What happens is a sort of a pumping effect where you get smoke out, air in, smoke out, air in. And this is the speed. It's not quicker, it's not slower. It's about this speed. Smoke out, air in, smoke out, air in. And this happens about 10 times. Just enough time for the room to get enough oxygen to explosively burn all those burning gas, all those fire gases that were remaining in the room but couldn't burn. And then you get a sort of explosive explosion-like flame that gets out of the door. So don't stand in front of the door. Never healthy. On YouTube, if you look for Backdraft, there are many spectacular movies. So short clips showing you what a Backdraft can do, and it's pretty impressive. So a Backdraft is something that, as a firefighter, you should really be careful about, and always look out for. Always check. Always open the room carefully. See what happens with the smoke. Is there a pumping thing going on? And if so, well, what you could do is open the door for a few seconds and spray water to the ceiling as to cool the room, because at some point maybe you get then an explosive mixture, but if the temperature is low enough, it won't ignite. That's one thing you can do, or you can break a window and force a backdraft, but then in a direction that's safe to everybody else. It depends on the situation what kind of solution you would take. So don't, and again, don't try this at home, right? I've seen at training centers simulated backdrafts using shipping containers, where at one end there is a wall created, and behind the wall there's a door in the wall, and behind that they just throw in pallets one after the other. It's hugely huge fire. It's very hot. At some point they will close the door. You wait a few seconds so it can create burnable gases, but nothing much happens. And then you open it and you get a backdraft, but then in a controlled setting. So having the right gear, making sure the process is under control, it's really very, very cool to witness. But because what you get is not so much of an explosive backdraft, but you get a flow of gases that could burn but are not burning yet over the ceiling, because they're hot gases, over the ceiling of the shipping container, and then there, because it's still warm inside, they're ignited. So it's more of a, when you look up, you see a sea of flames. It's sort of a sea with waves and created by some flames. So it's warm, but at the same time, it's very beautiful to look at. Again, don't try this at home. Don't make an installation like that unless you know what you're doing. And if you've never heard of firefighting before, you probably don't, so don't do this. If you want to witness this in a controlled environment, just apply. Become a volunteer firefighter. Why not? There's a shortage in a lot of areas, at least in the Netherlands. And I can imagine it's the same in other countries. And why not step up to the plate and be all you can be and do some adventurous stuff? Okay, anyway, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Like the last two episodes, I would say if you have any more questions regarding firefighting, just put them in the comments. And if there are any, I'll address it in a fourth episode. And if not, well, then three is as much as it was. I'll figure out. I've got enough other subjects to do podcasts about. So, hope you enjoyed it. This is Jeroen Betten again, signing off. Maybe seeing you at OrgCamp is already gone. If you hear this, so I hope you enjoyed OrgCamp. I did, probably, I guess. Maybe in March you will go to Cloudfest in Munich, Germany. If you do, I've got a surprise for you, but that's for another day. Okay, so till we meet again, bye bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.